Today's episode of the Axon Credit Podcast is brought to you by Gusto. Gusto offers modern, easy payroll benefits and HR to small businesses across the country. They were even named Best Online Payroll by PC Magazine. And as a listener, you get 3 months free when you run your first payroll. Sign up and give it a try at gusto.com/creative. Hey everyone, welcome to the Axon Creative Podcast. My name is Todd Henry. I am your host. So here are a few questions for you. What do James Bond and Lipitor have in common? Why do traffic jams appear out of nowhere on the highway? And what can we learn about innovation from a glass of water? These are just a few of the kinds of questions that physicist and entrepreneur Safi Bacall talks about in his new book, Loon Shots. We're going to talk today with Safi about how to nurture crazy ideas that win wars, cure diseases, and transform industries. It is a fascinating conversation, and I think it applies to any of us who have to go to work and make it up every day, right? Those of us who want to do big things in the world. Safi is going to help us think about how to cultivate and support loon shots inside of our organization. Before we dive into that, I want to let you know today's episode is brought to you by Gusto. So if you have a business or if you know someone who does, we all do, you probably know that small business owners wear a ton of hats. And some of these hats are great. They're things that we love to do, probably the reason we started the business to begin with. But some things like filing taxes and running payroll, not exactly so great and not necessarily the thing that we signed up for when we started a business. And that's where Gusto comes in. Gusto makes payroll, taxes, and HR actually easy for small businesses. Fast, simple payroll processing, benefits, and expert HR support all in one place. Gusto automatically pays and files your federal, state, and local taxes, so you don't have to worry about it. And they make it easy to add health benefits and even a 401k for your team. Those old school clunky payroll providers just weren't built for the way that modern small businesses work, but Gusto is. Now is the time to get started. Listeners to the Axon Creative get 3 free months when they run their first payroll. Try a demo and see it for yourself at gusto.com/creative. That's gusto.com/creative. And we thank Gusto for sponsoring this episode of the Axon Creative Podcast. So our guest today is Safi Bacall. He's the author of a new book called Loon Shots, How to Nurture the Crazy Ideas That Win Wars, Cure Diseases, and Transform Industries. Safi, welcome to the Axon Creative Podcast.
Thanks, Todd. Glad to be here.
So first of all, just out of the gate, I love this term loon shots. I'm going to be adopting that and using it at every turn and giving you full credit for that phrase. I love that phrase. How do you define loon shot? What is a loon shot?
Well, everybody knows what a moonshot is. It's a big, exciting goal that everybody agrees is going to have a lot of significance. But the important thing to keep in mind is that a moonshot is a destination. When Kennedy first used the term in 1961, it was, we're going to put a man on the moon. That's a big, exciting goal. But how do we get there? And in fact, when you look back through history, there's lots of moonshots, but the things that really make the difference, that change the course of science, business, or history, turn out to be those crazy ideas that have been floating around for a long time, neglected or dismissed, and their champions are written off as nuts or unhinged. And in fact, even in the example of the original moonshot with Kennedy in 1961, how did we get there? Well, a rocket. Well, where did the idea of a rocket and jet propulsion come from? Robert Goddard. In 1920, 4 decades earlier, Robert Goddard has suggested this idea. Why don't we explode, use liquid fuel for jet propulsion and generate something that can shoot up into the sky and maybe into outer space? He was completely ridiculed. The New York Times actually published an editorial and said this, you know, quote, Professor Robert Goddard in some university, Clark University, doesn't understand the basic principles of physics that we teach high school students, you know, Newton's laws, action, reaction, that would never work. Hmm. What was funny was that 49 years later, after the Apollo 11 mission to the moon took off, the Times issued a retraction. And they said, today marks the first successful loon shots. You know, 49 years ago, we issued this story. And in fact, rockets do not violate the laws of physics. The Times regrets the error.
Well, good for them for issuing the retraction, I guess, right?
Yeah, but the point of the story is that that happens far more commonly than you think, that the big ideas, that they're important breakthroughs, nobody could foresee. You can't really predict what will happen with an idea or what market. But what you can tell is that it's challenging conventional wisdom. Yeah. And so it is, in fact, those ideas, the ones that are dismissed or written off as crazy and have been lingering for decades. And that's true not just, you know, the rockets was one example, but it's certainly true in science, in drug discovery, where I've worked for many years, in physics, where I worked before that, even in the arts, even in films and movies. It's the ideas that everybody says will never work, can't work, whether it's a business or a product or a strategy, that are the ones that tend to be the most important. So the bottom, to answer your question, the moonshot is a goal. Nurturing loonshots is how we get there.
Oh, that's great. And there are a couple of kinds of loonshots that you describe in the book. You talk about P types and S types. Could you explain what those are and maybe give an example of each?
Sure. Well, a P type is a product. The idea is, and the reason I make that distinction is not just, you know, for some academic fun. I'm not an academic, but it's because people tend to have one kind of blind side. There are a lot of people who, let's say, think of themselves as great technologists. And those are the kinds of guys who look for great products, great technology breakthroughs. And they sometimes miss the small changes in strategy or business model that have nothing to do with a product, no new technology whatsoever, that make all the difference. So I'll give you an example. I mean, obviously, you know, talking a lot about Steve Jobs has almost become a business cliche, but just because people are very familiar with him. When Steve Jobs first started out, he saw himself as this big technology guy, and he championed new technologies. He didn't invent the Mac, but there was another guy at the early Apple who came up with the idea of the Mac. But, you know, he championed that technology, and he championed another technology with Next, and he championed all these various technologies, and he saw himself as this great product guy. Well, Apple almost went bankrupt because for his first stint at Apple, he caused a lot of disruption. And then when he went to Next, he really saw himself as this great product guy, and that was a disaster. Next was also going bankrupt. What he missed was that there was a subtle shift in strategy going on in the industry, a shift to software rather than hardware. And in fact, several people had approached him and said, "Hey, you're software that you've developed for Next, this operating system, is awesome. It's actually much better than this Windows stuff." Because at the time, this was very early Windows. Right. It's much better. And these other companies, these competitors, these PC makers, IBM and the Compaq and the many others, they were kind of desperate to get away from the Windows emerging monopoly. And so they kept coming to him and said, "Listen, why don't you just forget the hardware stuff and be a software company?" And he was like, "No, that's ridiculous. I'm a product guy." So he had a blind spot. His blind spot was he was a P type, and he was a product type, and I always want the fastest, coolest new technology. And he missed a subtle shift in strategy, which was that software ended up mattering a lot more. So actually, I'll give you another example of the same era, IBM. People think, well, you know, IBM got killed in the late 80s and 90s and had to do massive layoffs because their PC business got killed. But what people don't realize is that IBM was a very innovative product company. They were the dominant company, hardware company, technology company in the country, if not the world. The entire computer industry was called IBM and the Seven Dwarfs.
Yeah.
And people think, you know, big companies can't innovate, like, oh, maybe they missed the PC revolution. No, they innovated terrifically. They actually, as soon as the personal computer came out, first it was, there were some small, you know, Commodore and then Apple and then Tandy Radio Shack. And then IBM got in the game. They weren't first. They might have been, you know, a year or two later. They just wiped them away. IBM went to number one within 3 or 4 years. I don't know if you're old enough to remember, but the IBM PC and XT and all that stuff.
Oh, yeah.
They were by far the dominant. So they actually became number one. And what did they do? They said, well, you know, we are a personal computer. We're a computer company. We're a hardware company. We've been a hardware company for our whole lives, and that's how we make money. They were a phenomenal P-type innovator. So in order to do that, they said, you know what, we'll just outsource a couple of these things that don't matter. I don't know, something like the microprocessors. That's just a component. So we'll give it to this little struggling company called Intel. And then, you know, software is a dime a dozen, a lot of little software companies. So we'll give it to this little company in Seattle called Microsoft.
Right.
So they outsourced that stuff, and they were the big king. So they also had a blind spot about what mattered. They just thought products and boxes and hardware mattered, and they missed the subtle change in strategy of what mattered. So the reason that the distinction is interesting is, like, let's say you're a technology person and you love fancy gadgets. You tend to have kind of blinders on fancy gadgets, and you miss the small shifts in strategy that can make a huge difference. I'll give you one where, here's an example. Walmart, you know, if Walmart was a country, I think it would be ranked like 17 or 18 in the world in GDP.
Isn't that crazy? That is just an amazing stat.
It is incredible. And so did Sam Walton, when he built his company and wiped out all of discount retailing, did he do any new technology?
No. Not at first, No.
He just moved his stores somewhere else.
Yeah.
He moved his stores to rural areas. Actually, that, as I kind of mentioned in the book, that wasn't by design. It was kind of an accident and serendipitous. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't matter. He just moved his store and figured out how to sell stuff a little bit cheaper. Like a dime, you know, just a few percent. And that was a small shift in strategy, but it wiped out all his competitors. There was no technology. So the reason it's interesting is just to become, is it can help people become more self-aware. And it applies very broadly. If you're a scientist, you might work on, or a chemist or a biologist, let me, you know, create this new drug or that new drug and see how it works. But the S-type equivalent is, let me take an existing drug and apply it somewhere totally different. Mm-hmm. I'll give you a really weird example. Have you heard of thalidomide?
I have.
Thalidomide is probably the most infamous drug in history. It caused, it was given for morning sickness because it was an incredibly powerful and effective sedative in the 1950s. 40s, 50s, up through, I forget the exact date off the top of my head, but it was given as a sedative, especially in Europe, and discovered not long thereafter that it caused deformation in babies. So it grew into this horrific drug with these horrific pictures of children born with deformed limbs. And it was banned forever. And about 20 or 30 years later, there was a team in Boston looking for a new drug that could help fight cancers by blocking blood vessels. So they kind of searched through, and one of them is a guy I knew very well who worked with us at our biotech company, Judah Folkman, said, you know, if something blocks blood vessels, it would probably be pretty bad for pregnant women. Why don't we just do a search through a database of drugs that block blood vessels? Through our database of drugs that are teratogenic, that are indicated to be very bad for pregnant women. And up came, of course, thalidomide. So he said, well, why don't we test that in the lab? It was him and a postdoc working with him named Bob D'Amato. Why don't we test that in the lab? And they found, sure enough, it was an incredibly potent inhibitor of blood vessels. So not long thereafter, there was a young woman in New York who had stage 4 or advanced multiple myeloma, and she was just calling around everybody she could find, and she got a hold of Judah Folkman's name, called him up in Boston and said, you know, my husband has multiple myeloma, what do you think? And he said, well, there's this drug thalidomide, and it was this terrible drug, but we think, you know, it could work for your husband's disease. And they tried it. It didn't actually work for her husband. It was a little too late. But the second patient they gave it to had this remarkable remission of his cancer. And that drug, thalidomide, became the first major new approved therapy for multiple myeloma, which was transforming lives in decades. So that's an example of an S-type idea in science. You didn't invent a new drug. You just thought cleverly had a different strategy. Sam Walton moving stores to rural areas and pricing stuff, you know, 10% left is a different strategy.
Yeah.
It's not about creating a fancy new project. And the reason that becoming self-aware of, are you a P-type innovator or an S-type innovator? Do you like to think of new uses for stuff and create different ideas and different strategies and different models? Or do you like to create hard new gadgets? Right. The reason becoming a little more self-aware about that can be useful is that if you can learn to be ambidextrous, to do both of them, you can become incredibly powerful. If you're naturally a P-type innovator, if you learn those S-type skills to think when you have a new product, what are all the different strategies? How could it change, you know, customers or markets or competitors and all the different ways we can flip this around and use it for new uses? You could enormously grow the reach of your product or your idea.
So what are some ways for people to begin to identify that? Because I think that's you've really hit a nerve, I'm sure, with a lot of listeners who say, wait a minute, I think I might have a blind spot in one or the other of those areas. You know, what are some ways that we can deal with that blind spot?
Well, you know, becoming self-aware is half the battle. And I'll give you an example with Steve Jobs. So obviously he started off like a lot of young entrepreneurs in Silicon Valley, but everywhere, you know, with a tech mindset. I'm a pure technology guy. And then he went, you know, he had a 10-year period that he disappeared and that he worked on other things, including having a stake in Pixar. And that opened him to the stake that he had in Pixar, although he originally bought it for a technology reason. He acquired George Lucas's film operation, Lucas, the computer group from Lucasfilm. And they had this big computer. So he bought it for the same sort of P-type innovator. I'm going to build a bigger, faster computer, and I'm going to show those guys at Apple who kicked me out, you know, that I can build something really cool in technology. So they had a very small team working also on this thing called films, animation. And that really, the product, the computer that he bought was a flop. And so that went nowhere, as well as the computer project at Next went nowhere. But the film stuff started going really well. And that opened his mind that there are other ways to think about business. And when he came back to Apple, what did he do? He took, for example, songs, and he put them online at 99 cents a song. There was no real technology. Everybody was putting anything online and downloading whatever. There wasn't any technology in that. It's just that it was a strategy that everybody said couldn't work. You know, there was music piracy was rampant. Like, are you crazy? Who's going to pay money when all these songs are for free? I don't know if you remember the days of Napster. But it was like, if you imagine yourself back then where everybody's using Napster, it was like, and somebody said, yeah, someone's going to charge you for downloading all this stuff that's of it. You would have said, oh yeah, that's nuts. And that's what they told him. And they said, who's going to pay for that? And then if not, there's radio online, you know, and then the radio services. So like who would ever do this? So he put it online and guess what? They had, I don't know how many millions of downloads in the first couple of days.
Right.
So he had learned to become an S-type innovator in addition to a P-type innovator. What made Apple so successful? One of the things, obviously they had good design, but one of the underlying cores or the foundation was in the 10 years they had gone, Apple had said, started to follow the IBM, the PC model of licensing out its technology, and Apple clones had started appearing in large part because people in the industry said, nobody wants a closed ecosystem. Everybody wants freedom of choice, because IBM had tried that for a little while and IBM had failed. They'd built this thing called OS2 and it was a complete flop.
Yes.
So that was another strategy that everybody said failed. So going to a closed system wasn't a technology thing. It was just a strategic choice. And he said, I think there's money to be made in that. Mm-hmm. I think that IBM did it and failed, but that was kind of a false fail. They just did it wrong. So he did another, those couple of things that he did with, you know, paying online and creating stores, none of them were new technologies, they were new strategies.
Yes.
So he had become ambidextrous. He was also a P-type guy, and then he had learned over 10 or so years to become an S-type guy. And that's the power of being able to see both. Imagine if you're a scientist and you're not only good at creating a new drug, but good at finding so many uses for that drug.
Right.
Or you're an artist and you're not only good at just creating a brilliant, work of art, whatever your medium is, but you're really smart about thinking all the ways to get that out there in the world and to all the ways you can monetize that. Those are two totally different skills. One is a P-type, your product, whatever it is, and one is an S-type, whatever that is.
Yeah.
So, you know, the trick is first become self-aware, which do you think you are? And then once you've identified if you're a P-type or an S-type, there are two things you can do. One is figure out who do you know who is the opposite and just study them. What are they doing? Read everything you can about them. Dive into their history. I learned by far the most from reading histories and biographies. It's incredible what people will tell you in a biography, and people like to talk about themselves. So people will, and you learn far more from their failures than their successes. So figure out who's a good S-type person, and if you're an artist, who do you know that does that well, that S-type stuff? Well, find a couple people and figure out everything you can about them. There's a lot of stuff online. You just Google, read their interviews that they give to magazines or articles or listen to the podcast. People say a ton of stuff on podcasts that, you know, you can't find on print. So number one is, if you want to get better, if you want to become ambidextrous, number one, figure out who's really good at that opposite side, at your blind spot, and then just dive into the internet and find everything you can about them, especially not just the things they did well, but where they screwed up, because that's where you'll actually learn the most. So that's kind of number one, if you want to go on your own and improve your own skills. The other is, if you know you're part of a team, make absolutely sure you complement yourself with someone who's really good at the other side. If you're a great, great product person, find someone who's a great, great strategy person, mm-hmm. and listen to them. Don't think or make the mistake that just because you're a great pro, and this is just an incredibly common trap. Actually, I read about a couple of people who are legendary entrepreneurs whose business has completely collapsed because of this trap. But people rise up very high, and you know, they might be a product innovator and it works for quite a while. They just keep creating better product and they don't have to worry about subtle strategies that might be on the distant horizon that are coming to kill them. But if you are one of those P-type great product innovators, or that's how you see yourself, the number one, and you don't really have the energy or bandwidth to try to develop that other skill, then the main thing you can do is just get humble. But that's your strength, and find someone else who can complement you on that other side and listen to them. Don't overrule them. Don't say like, hey, you don't know anything. When was the last time you created a product? Products are everything. Technology is everything. I don't want to hear about all this strategy stuff and blah, blah, blah. That's boring or stupid or for business people or whatever. Big mistake. That's exactly how you bankrupt yourself and your business.
Yeah.
So those are the two things. Either read about someone who's good, or find someone and be humble and listen to them.
That's great. I love that. Well, we have barely scratched the surface. This book is so dense. There's so much great insight, wisdom, even advice about how to cultivate loonshots within your organization, how to create a loonshot nursery. We've been talking with Safi Bacall. He's the author of Loonshots, How to Nurture the Crazy Ideas That Win Wars, Cure Diseases, and Transform Industries. Safi, thanks so much for taking the time to be with us today.
Thanks. Delighted to be on your show.
Well, again, many thanks to Safi Bacall for taking the time to be with us today and for sharing insights from Loonshots. If you like this episode, make sure you subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts or join the conversation at collective.accidentalcreative.com. Remember, friends, cover bands don't change the world. Don't be a cover band. You need to find your unique voice if you want to thrive. We'll see you next time.